We are here in our cause number CV120195 involving Markham Contracting Company Inc. versus First American Title. The time set for oral argument. Each side will have 20 minutes. Appellants, we will let you manage your clock if you would like to save some time for rebuttal. As you come forward, please identify yourselves and your client. We're recording this, and to the extent we have to listen to the argument later on, we want to make sure we don't get confused. We have read the briefs. We've conferenced this matter. We believe that we understand what the issues are with that in mind.
Thank you, Judge Portley. May it please the court, my name is Robert Schaefer, counsel for the appellant, First American Title Company. This case is an equitable lien foreclosure action in which the issue of priority was tried to the court with an advisory jury. Now, because the trial court was the ultimate decision maker of both the facts and the law, the trial court had both the authority and the obligation to conduct its own review of the record and to make both factual determinations and to apply the law of the case to the facts. Unfortunately, the trial court in several respects failed to exercise that authority and simply deferred to the advisory jury's findings that were clearly erroneous and unsupported by the evidence in many respects, including a factual finding that counsel for Markham had conceded in closing argument to be incorrect.
Which argument had Markham conceded to have been incorrect?
It was this claim that the pre-wet system had been set up prior to June 20th, 2005, and I believe Ms. Palacek conceded in closing argument that the only evidence was presented by Robert Mata, the project manager for Markham, and he had testified that that pre-wet system was not set up until after the 4th of July. So that was a concession in closing argument.
But there were, at least as I thought I understood, other information about what Markham or its subs had done prior to June 20th of 2008.
That's correct.
Okay.
And First American doesn't dispute that there was some work done out there on this property prior to June 20th.
But as to that one system, to the extent that the jury and or the judge relied upon that, then that would have been erroneous, but not as to the others.
Well, that's correct. But that point, and the reason I raised the pre-wet system is because it's indicative, I think, of how the trial court simply deferred to the jury's findings. The jury simply marked every item of work for Markham as having been done before June 20th, and the trial court didn't give any indication on the record, either orally or in writing, that he had reviewed the record and made his own determination.
Does he have to?
No, he doesn't have to.
Oh, okay.
He doesn't have to. But
if I understood your concession just now, you said you conceded that Markham did do work on site prior to June 20th.
That is correct, and that concession was made in the briefs. There's no dispute that there was work done on March the 29th. Now, whether that work was done by Markham, it's unclear, but beside the point, I think, because Markham hired TBE, which was the subcontractor that went out and punched the 7 potholes in the ground to locate the utilities. But before we get into all that, I'd like to return to the threshold issue, which is, I think, a dispositive issue, and the court rules in favor of the appellant on that issue, it doesn't need to wade into the record at all. Doesn't need to look at whether any work was done prior to June 20th. Doesn't need to look at whether that work was done pursuant to Markham's contract with the owner.
So you're going to rely on the honor about issue and the concessions and the complaint and the notice?
Well, I think it's a dispositive issue, and
sure.
And as a matter of law, judgment should have been entered on that issue. And the reason is clear, and let me proceed in 2 steps. First, in the answering brief, Markham does not dispute that the statements it made in its notice of claim, a notice of lien and claim of lien, and its allegations in its complaint, it does not dispute that those are binding judicial admissions. So then the second step is, well, how can it get out of those binding judicial admissions? And can it get out of those binding judicial admissions by arguing that whether work done on a date in March or April was on or about July 7th, 2005, whether that is a fact issue. And it's our position, respectfully, that this is not a fact issue. And the reason why it's not a fact issue is because in the Gittner Engineering case, this court held directly that when a date is not in close proximity to a particular date that's on or about that date, then as a matter of law, it doesn't create a fact issue.
Let me ask you, are you saying it's not a fact issue, or the fact is established and cannot be challenged?
What is not a fact issue is whether a date 3 or 4 months before a specified date that's given in the binding statement. So in this case, we have a binding notice of lien and a binding complaint that says on or about July 7, 2005. Now, as I understand the argument, and what the trial court allowed Markham to argue at trial, was that, well, this potholing works was done on March the 29th, and that's a date in close proximity to July 7th.
But there was other work done after March 29th to before June 20th. At least there's evidence of that.
Well, I disagree with that, okay. Judge Kessler, and I'm happy to address each and every one of those items, but unfortunately it takes parsing this record very closely, because there were several witnesses that testified when work was done. But when you look at the actual testimony, the only evidence in this record that supports work being done prior to June 20th was as to the potholing work, and then there was blue staking done, which we dispute is even lienable work, and then there was maybe some trash that was picked up prior to June 20th,
You've got testimony, I understand it, that says, for example, putting aside whether blue staking is lienable, we're required to blue stake every 2 weeks, every 14 days, and blue stake would come out, and that's visible. Those don't fade. It started in March, March 23rd, or a few days thereafter. And then we talk about barricades.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but to address those issues, there's a difference between what was argued in closing and the arguments that were presented in the briefs in terms of what inferences are properly drawn in this case.
I'm looking at transcripts.
Well, if you look at the actual transcript, it does say that there was markings that were done every 2 weeks, and we don't dispute that. Our argument is that that work is not lienable work.
I said let's put that aside.
Okay.
I mean, I understand your argument on that, but you're saying the only thing that was done was March 29th, and that's not on or about. That's
well,
what we're trying to get at.
If I said that, I overstated it. It was the March 29th was the potholing work. The
right.
blue staking
okay.
was
blue
ordered
staking is now
in connection
every, so
with
you can
that.
See that there is evidence that blue staking was done every 2 weeks,
correct.
Starting sometime late in March.
Well, I'm not sure that the evidence actually shows the blue staking was done every 2 weeks. What the evidence was that blue stake would go back out to the site every 2 weeks and make sure that the lines were still visible.
Okay.
So that was the evidence with respect to the blue staking. So correct. As to the potholing, the blue staking, we don't dispute that to the extent that that's, I mean, it was done prior to June 20th. The question is whether it's pursuant to the contract, whether it's, as to the blue staking, whether it's lienable work. As to both the potholing and the blue staking, whether it was done pursuant to Markham's later June 28th contract, and that's the contract that it's requesting lien rights under, and also whether that work was actual visible work under the standard that applies. So, yeah. So I think we've, unless the court has any more questions about whether these statements are binding and whether Markham ought to be able to present testimony and evidence at trial that directly contradicts its binding admissions, then that issue is settled.
Let me ask it somewhat a different way. Were you allowed to offer evidence on behalf of your client that that the July 7 date had been used in declarations. Was that presented to the jury?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But the issue was whether the jury should have been allowed.
I understand your position,
yeah.
So they had both prior declarations under oath saying
correct.
On or about July 7, 2005.
Correct.
And then additional evidence showing that it happened actually prior to June. Several things happened, according to your opponent,
right.
prior to June 20, 2005. The jury had all that evidence to consider.
Well, the jury and the judge. Yeah, the trial court was the ultimate decider on this case.
And the jury came back with verdicts saying a bunch of specifically enumerated things had occurred on the property on or before, to use a vague term, June 20, 2005, correct? And the trial court adopted that in a way that you believe the record either doesn't reflect or was improper.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. Yeah. And as to the on or about issue, there was testimony at trial that when Markham recorded its notice of claim in April of 2008, information was supplied to Ms. Palasek, who completed that notice of lien, and that information was the employee time cards on this particular project, this work project. At trial, what Markham was allowed to do was to rely on different evidence that there were subcontractors and unpaid employees or employees that had billed work on other jobs.
Or salaried employees.
That had done other work. But that just goes to show that Markham was allowed to change its story.
And your position is that time should have frozen when that notice was submitted, is that correct? In other words, after acquired discovery, should not have been allowed at trial?
Correct. I mean, if Markham, statements in a notice and claim of lien are binding, and that point has not been disputed in the case. And what that means is that, if we're talking about, was the work done on, June 18th or June 23rd or July 5th or July 9th, wiggle room either way would be fine. But this court isn't being asked to say whether on or about is 2 or 3 days or 4 days or a week.
Let me ask though, where, and that's a phrase that's used often in pleadings. Perhaps it should be, perhaps it shouldn't be, but it is. There's a slippery slope. You're saying 3 months is too long, but 3 weeks is not. Where does that teeter-totter tip?
Well, I think 3 weeks is too long, too.
I'd heard you say June 18 would have been okay.
Well, I don't think it would have been okay. I think a couple of days.
Perhaps I misheard you.
Yeah, a couple of days either way of the July 7th date would be on or about July 7th. So, 3 weeks earlier or 3 months earlier. I mean, I think practitioners of this state would be very surprised if this court issues an opinion that says on or about can be construed by someone as meaning 3 or 4 months earlier.
Let me set surprise aside and talk about cases that are out there. What's your best case for the proposition that on or about could not mean the dates applicable here?
Well, it's the Gittner-Louvier engineering case from 1977 where the plaintiff had stated the date of the trespass in its complaint, and that date was more than 2 years before the plaintiff included the proper defendants in an amended complaint. And the court said, no, you stated the date of the trespass in the complaint, and this date that you're now arguing is a large number of days, more than 100 days beyond that date. And the court said, as a matter of law, no one could construe on or about as meaning about 100 days. And the only difference between that case and this case, and it's an argument that was made by the appellee, is that in the Gittner case, the court went on to say, and there was no testimony that the trespass occurred any other time. And here, I guess, the argument is that we have testimony that this work was done in March. But there is no testimony in this case that work was done pursuant to the contract. And it's an important point, and I want to emphasize that. What the appellee cites is testimony on page 80 of Micah Aronson, and this was 7:15 in the morning at page 80. And the question was asked, Okay, and how about, in fact, sometimes do owners tell you to do work on an hourly basis or time and material basis before the actual final price is agreed upon between the parties? And then the answer, he answers, typically they, when we have our pre-construction meeting or when we're working on a job, if we come to something we're not sure about, we will do time and material because we don't know what the cost is going to be. And then it's adjusting the contract. And that's like we put the contingencies in the bid abstract or in the contract documents so the owner has a venue to draw against when something arises. Then the next question. In fact, sometimes those numbers are rolled into the final written contract. Answer, that's correct. And in this case, did Markham some potholing work on the project that was paid on an hourly basis? Answer, yes, the work was performed on an hourly basis. And then I'll skip down to line 21 of page 81. Okay, and the potholing work that was done in this March time period, Markham does, or within the scope of your bid abstract, is that the type of work, part of the scope of the contract that Markham was going to perform on Lindsay Park Townhomes? And then we have an extensive back and forth where it's clear that the witness is not giving the answer that the lawyer wants to hear. And it says, and finally, what the lawyer extracts is, but it still was in the same general scope of your utility work of your contract, right? And then the answer, are we talking about the TBE? Yes, the TBE. Answer, I don't know whether it was. I don't know that. I guess I'm not sure how to answer that. It wasn't part of the dash. You mean, was that included in the actual final contract amount? And the answer was never given that this work was rolled into the contract. And there are two reasons, I think, why that answer was never given. It was never given because, first of all, the contract price didn't change on that issue from early on. In other words, this potholing work was paid, it was invoiced to the old owner, it was paid by the old owner, and the amount of the contract did not change. So what that shows is this work was done outside the contract. It was also work that if the parties had intended to roll this work into the contract, work done in March of 05, they wouldn't have agreed that the date of commencement of work was June 28th. And that's an important point because the contract in this case may not be binding in the same sense that the notice of claim and that the complaint are binding, but it's binding in the sense that under Taylor, parties are not allowed to introduce evidence to contradict unambiguous terms of their contract. And in this case, Markham was allowed to get a ruling by the advisory jury that was affirmed by the judge without even really presenting testimony that contradicted its contract, but it just was sort of, well, sometimes this work is rolled into contracts. But nobody ever really testified in this case that, yes, we sat down with the owner and we agreed that this work would be rolled into the contract. And in fact, if that testimony had been offered, it would have been easily impeached by the contract itself because the contract says that the date of commencement of work was June 28, 2005. So if the parties had intended to roll this earlier work into the contract, they wouldn't have put in their contract that the date of commencement was June 28, 2005. Now, there is evidence that the work started before June 28th, on June 22nd, and we don't dispute that, but it doesn't matter because the deed of trust priority date is June 20th, and there's no dispute about that. So I apologize, I had a lot to cover, and I'll try to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Eric Frazier on behalf of Markham Contracting Company. With me at council table is Thomas Hudson. If you'll allow me, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal on our cross appeal. I'd like to step back before we get into the arguments and think about what this case is really about. This case is about a construction lender trying to wipe out a site developer who performed work on the property and had a valid lien. But apparently that construction lender never even visited the property to determine whether work had actually begun. Under these circumstances, Arizona law protects materialmen, protects contractors. I'd like to address three things. First, of course, is our use of the phrase on or about. Second is the evidence supporting the judgment. Third is whether Markham's work establishes lien priority. I also plan on addressing our cross appeal on post-judgment interest. Now, on the phrase on or about,
Do you agree that Gittner is the controlling case and limits our analysis of what it might mean?
I absolutely agree that Gittner is the controlling case here, and I'd like to jump right to that. The interval of considering Gittner here was almost 5 months. So to say that Gittner stands for the proposition that on or about as a matter of law is limited to two or three days simply isn't accurate. And the court stressed in that case that there was no contradicting evidence, no evidence that established when the events actually happened. Here, we had abundant testimony about when the events actually happened, and courts don't turn a blind eye to the evidence in the face of this uncertain term. The term on or about is uncertain, and we acknowledge that these documents are binding, but they're binding for what they say, which is on or about. That requires the jury to determine, as a matter of fact, when the events actually happened.
Well, Gittner seems to suggest that it can only mean a date in close proximity to the one mentioned, and it may not get back to March.
That's right. So the holding in Gittner is absolutely right. It's a date in close proximity. But I don't think that rephrasing gets us much closer to an answer as a matter of law what the phrase on or about means. You still have to determine when the events actually happened. How approximate can we be? That's a fact question that the jury has to decide. We're not aware of any case in which a court actually denied relief to a party for use of the phrase on or about when that party proved when the events actually occurred.
You mean in the civil context?
In criminal or civil.
Criminal context, an indictment could allege on or about that's 4 months off and not face constitutional scrutiny?
The issue is when the party who used the phrase on or about later proves when the events took place.
Could they amend, at least from an indictment, if in fact the facts show that it was March as opposed to June of the criminal act?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, that's possible.
Let me ask you sort of a broader question. I think both parties agree that lien notices should be as accurate as they can be. Is that fair?
Yes.
Now, and I won't ask you if, in hindsight, if you were drafting the notice here, you might have used a somewhat different date. But isn't the best way to ensure accuracy in notices keeping the on or about pretty tight, pretty narrow?
Well, Your Honor, the legislature actually does not require a date to be on the notice and claim of liens. Now, the current statute doesn't require that date. The purpose of this notice and claim of lien isn't to identify with particularity when labor commenced. And in fact, I'll go back
but
to
it,
the...
But it did here. It listed a date. Right?
That's right.
And so we're given that. And the question is, how far can we stray, or how far can a court, or how far can a party, or how far can a jury stray from a date that by its terms is intended to be somewhat approximate?
Right. That's
but
right.
This whole case turns on the magic of June 20, 2005. I mean, the whole case turns on what happened before or after that date. So dates are really important in this context.
That's right. And the jury heard where that date came from, and the jury heard the testimony about when the events actually occurred. The jury saw the documents about when the blue staking, when the potholing occurred. So if we're concerned about the construction lender, the right option is for the construction lender to visit the property, to ask questions, determine when construction actually began.
Even when a lien notice may say a date after that they wouldn't be concerned about?
Well, the lien notice comes years after
I
construction,
understand.
So it won't affect behavior then. And that's what we have a discovery process for, to determine what is the evidence supporting the validity and the timeliness of the lien. We have that in the discovery process, and then we introduce that evidence at trial.
What if instead of July 7, 2005, the lien notice said the date of the notice? Would you be making the same argument?
I'm not sure what you mean.
It is 2 years later. Is 2 years on or about?
Oh, I see. I see.
There has to be, well, let me ask you, there has to be some bound to on or about, doesn't there?
Right, and that bound will be context specific.
Sure.
So that's why.
And here you're arguing that right. The facts that you supported indicate it was within on or about.
Right.
What would be beyond on or about?
Well, there certainly will be a point at which no reasonable jury could find, as a matter of fact, that these events were within that time range. But this is the easy case, and this is 17 days, and we don't need to announce a rule that's broader than that, because this is a question of fact. We don't need to announce a rule as a matter of law when the precise bounds and all circumstances of the phrase.
But that's the context in which we consider this case. Surely you understand that.
Yes.
Why do you say 17 days?
Because we have 17 days from July 7th to get back to June 20th.
Right. But what work was done before June, around 17 days, but before June 20th?
Well, the testimony at trial showed that this work was continuous throughout the period.
Which work was done, let's say, within 3 or 4 days before June 20th?
I'm not sure exactly where the dates line up within 3 or 4 days, but we have testimony that blue staking was done every 2 weeks. But if we imagine a lien notice that said, on a particular date, on June 19th, for example, and then the contractor proved an even earlier date. We don't say the lien doesn't have priority because you made your case better. Markham proving dates that were even earlier than June 20th makes its lien stronger, not weaker.
Let me ask, your adversary and the briefs suggest that at least one of the special interrogatories that the jury answered was inconsistent with the party's concession. Do you view it the same way?
Well, I don't view the ultimate result the same way, because when there are 15 factual interrogatories.
Let me encourage you to set that aside for now, for just
okay.
With that one specific interrogatory. Do you read it the same way?
I do.
And so my words, not yours, the record doesn't support that interrogatory, fair? The interrogatory answer.
That particular answer of the pre-wet system, that's right.
And what should we take of that? What does that mean?
That means that we have 14 remaining factual interrogatories. The one interrogatory doesn't somehow infect the others. If there's substantial evidence supporting the other 14, the standard of review is the same, substantial evidence supporting those remaining 14. There's no authority that one incorrect finding infects the rest of the judgment. Right, we're here to determine whether the judgment was correct, whether we can affirm the judgment. Draw all reasonable inferences in favor of affirming, and there's abundant evidence about the remaining 14 topics.
How do we draw? We could argue a long time about what on or about means, but I think the underlying question is, when does a party get to go to the jury to dispute what on or about means? They say on or about July 7th. And they want to dispute that. How do we draw that line of when they can actually try to make it a fact issue? Is it a week? Is it a time differential that says, I mean, or is it some other factor that says, okay, this now becomes a fact issue?
Well, I think it depends on the context of the industry. We're talking here about liens and constructions. Hypotheticals involving a year or two simply won't come up, because you don't buy a property, hold on to it for years, and have construction start and have a question of years here. So in this industry, we're naturally bound to some interval.
It could, if you start construction and then, well, that's never been happened, but the economy falls apart and everybody stops construction on it and it sits for 2 years.
Right. Well, in that case,
then you could have a problem of 2 years, and what does honor about mean?
Yeah, well, there are other lien statutes that protect people in that case if work stops for a long period of time.
Okay.
But you know, I went through these cases one by one and saw that no court denies relief to a party who uses that phrase when it later proves the date, and no court actually denied relief in an interval this short.
When do they actually get to present evidence? That's what I'm trying to say. I mean, because we're trying to draw lines here,
mm-hmm.
saying, okay, you presented evidence that it occurred 6 months before. So that's on or about. But when do they actually, how do we draw a line that says, okay, we can pierce your pleading and let you get to a jury to decide what on or about means? Is there any idea of how we have to draw a line in this case?
We certainly don't have to draw a line in this case because this is the easy case, as I said. The interval here is not long. We cited cases involving longer intervals. So I don't think we need to draw a line in this case.
But if blue staking, let me put it this way, if blue staking were lienable work, and it occurred every 2 weeks, so presumably it occurred within 2 weeks before June 20th.
Right.
So let me ask you, the standard review on the from your perspective on the on or about is abuse of discretion, correct?
The on or about is substantial evidence, clearly erroneous.
So let me ask you, though, if the trial court here, instead of allowing you to present evidence, it said, no, it's too far, that same standard would apply, correct?
That's right.
Okay.
So I'd like to turn to what the jury actually found. The jury found that there were several different categories of work that began before June 20th, continuous throughout the period. And I'd like to talk a little bit about this concept that some of Markham's work didn't trigger lien priority. This is the bifurcation theory that was invented on appeal by First American, that it conceded that half of the work actually did begin before June 20th, not just the blue staking, but also the potholing and others. But that half of the work somehow doesn't give rise to a lien. First of all, that was waived because it was not addressed at trial below or in the post-judgment briefing. In First American's reply, it cited to three documents. Two of those are summary judgment papers, which aren't enough when a case goes to trial and the issue isn't raised in post-judgment briefing. The third of those was a single statement.
So there's no 50 or 50B motions?
There are, but this wasn't raised in those.
Okay.
Yeah. And the third citation was to a single statement in closing arguments by counsel that related only to blue staking, not potholing and not the other work. So that's not enough either, particularly because it wasn't in the post-judgment motions. But even if that's not a waiver, the argument simply is wrong. The First American cites two primary things for this argument. One is a principle from paragraph B of the lien statute, that's 33992B. Which is that work has to be apparent. But that requirement is only for professional services liens, things like architects, designers. The same is true for the cases it cites, almost all of which are from California, from out of state. And those also addressed off-site professional services work, like designers and architects working probably miles away in air-conditioned offices with nice furniture. Those cases and that statute does not apply to this case in which Markham was performing real work on-site on the land. There's no authority in Arizona or anywhere else saying that type of work isn't lienable and doesn't give rise to a lien in Arizona for on-site work. Now, I'd like to address this notion that the work wasn't done pursuant to the contract. The jury found, when asked three different ways, was this work done pursuant to the contract with OWCP 17 LLC? It answered three times, yes, yes, yes. That was supported by substantial evidence through the testimony of witnesses explaining that this was done pursuant to the contract. Moreover, Markham had a contractor with an owner before June 20th and was told to begin work. So at that point, the lien attached, and it runs with the land, so future subsequent owners take the land subject to that lien. We certainly don't want to invite mischief by allowing developers to extinguish lien rights by transferring properties between LLCs, by splitting things up among different contracts. That's not how the statutes work, and that's not how the industry works. Now, I plan to leave the topics of attorney's fees and the testimony of trial counsel, prejudgment interest, to the briefs, unless you have particular questions on those, and turn now to my cross-appeal, which concerns interest after entry of judgment. Now, under the plain text of Arizona's prompt pay statutes, an unpaid contractor is entitled to prompt pay interest until he has been paid. So that's true regardless of whether judgment has been entered or not. In fact, a contractor who never even
How does the Prompt Pay Act relate to the lien claim?
I'm not following your question, Your Honor.
On the one hand, if in fact you don't file your lien and you're just suing under the Prompt Pay Act, then that's statutory regime. But Markham is suing under the mechanics lien statute, which doesn't subsume the Prompt Pay Act provisions.
Right, but the Prompt Pay Act entitles unpaid contractors to prompt pay interest for amounts due pursuant to that section. That statute creates the amounts due when the contractor is unpaid.
And that's true regardless of who they're owed by? I mean, it doesn't matter who owes them the money?
Well, it says the owner, and so I think that's what you're getting at, Judge Thelma. And First American stands here in the shoes of its insured.
So if Deutsche Bank was the financing, let's just assume that the loan was ultimately sold to various investors, and it suddenly turns out a year or two down the line that some of the contractors weren't paid. All those investors are going to be owed 18% interest, because even though they had no interest in it until the lien was foreclosed on, they're liable for because they didn't pay promptly when the work was done?
Well, it's not that they didn't pay. And first of all, the difference here is that that New South, the construction lender, took title to the property at a trustee sale. So once they take title, they are the owner and they're owed prompt pay interest. They take the title subject to the liens and all the obligations associated with the lien.
Wouldn't that be of any – that's what I'm trying to get at. Where do you draw – we're down the line drawing.
Right.
What if a lender somewhere down the line forecloses a year or two later and suddenly it pops up that someone wasn't paid? They're going to be liable because they now stand in the shoes of the owner for 18% interest under a prompt pay statute where they had never contracted simply because they foreclosed, because now
right.
They're in the shoes. So there's no limit to that, right?
Well, this is what happens when you purchase property. You take it subject to all of the liens on the property, all the obligations associated
for sure.
with the property.
But do you take it subject to the – if you couldn't have made those payments when they were due, you're going to take it subject to the interest that the prior owner should have – was liable for on the interest?
We impose these obligations on subsequent purchasers all the time in the environmental context, for example. You take the property subject to the obligations.
But that's a different statutory scheme.
Sure, sure.
Completely, both state and federal.
That's right.
But here you've got the lien statutes and you've got the prompt pay statutes, and you want to conflate as to subsequent owners if... you know, the window guy figures out that, you know, there's an extra $5,000 he hasn't gotten, so this Deutsche Bank or whoever bought the derivatives now has to pay 5 plus the 18% for 10 years.
And that's why we do title searches, that's why we have due diligence, and that's why we have title insurers as well.
Well, they're liable under the obligation.
What's that?
They're liable for the obligation because they take it subject to anything that's been leaned on.
Right.
But why should they be? If they couldn't have made the payments in the first place, why should they be liable for what the prior owner should have paid the interest on that?
Right. Well, I mean, they didn't. Right.
They couldn't create that.
Right. They didn't enter into the contracts either. But they're subject to those.
If they couldn't be making the payments.
Right.
Why should they be liable for not making for the interest on not making the payments?
Well, the statute is designed to protect material liens, designed to protect the workers.
Right.
And so we have a party who's not been paid, presumably another party who hasn't been paid,
you sue the old owner.
Right.
You didn't pay me. I want to get paid, and I want 18% interest on it.
And then you sue the new owner because the new owner took the property subject to
the
obligation.
You can take it subject to the lien. You can use foreclosure lien, and that's your protection. The 18% is paid by the old owner.
If the old owner is still around.
You sue the old owner.
Right. I'd like to take my last 30 seconds to say, in the alternative, if you want to apply the default rate, I think it's a clear case that that all components of the judgment earn prompt pay and earn post-judgment interest, including pre-judgment interest. That's not a controversial position.
Isn't that compound interest?
It's not compound interest. In fact, that footnote 2 of the air separation case explains that this isn't compound interest. So I'd direct you to footnote 2 of the air separation case. But 9 federal courts of appeals and 10 states all think the same things. So, Your Honors, we ask that you affirm the judgment and award Markham prompt pay interest until Markham has been paid. Thank you.
Thank you.
Uh, Bob Schaefer on behalf of the appellant. Unless the court has any questions on the cross appeal, I'll use the remainder of my time to go back to the initial appeal. Judge Kessler, you asked the question about isn't this an exercise in line drawing? And it is an exercise in line drawing, and the line may be difficult to draw at the margins, but here we're standing so far away from the line, you have to use binoculars to see it. We're 3 to 4 months before July the 7th.
If we disagreed with you on the blue staking, right, if we disagreed and said blue staking is sufficient, then at the minimum, the blue staking takes us up to sometime within 2 weeks of June 20th.
I agree, but you would have to make the following findings, or you would have to find that there's evidence in the record, and really it's a legal issue as to whether blue staking is lienable, whether blue staking is sufficient to constitute the visible commencement of construction, mm-hmm. and whether the blue staking was done pursuant to the contract. Those are really mixed questions of law and fact. I mean, the bare facts of when it was done we don't dispute, but as to whether those things constitute, meet the legal standard is really a question subject to de novo review. So what counsel for Markham said is that the context is important, and I agree with that, because in the context here, one day can matter. And so when that's your context, on or about can't mean 3 to 4 months. And if it could mean 3 to 4 months, then why can't it mean a year? And in this case, there's evidence that there was soil sampling done back in 2003. Okay, that's work done on the project. If any labor on the project is sufficient, even if it doesn't leave any visible indication of labor, why couldn't a contractor like Markham, even if it did no work, point to soil sampling that was done a year earlier? There's nothing that would prevent it from doing that. The only thing that prevents it from doing that is the visibility requirement, the pursuant to requirement in 992E, and the requirement that it be done, I guess I said it already, pursuant to the visibility requirement.
So they'd have to, in order to do that, they'd have to leave a red flag in a soil sample that said we were here.
No, I think the point is that that work was done by a different contractor under a different contract, and the legislature recognized that separate contracts have separate priority dates.
Thank you very much.
And we appreciate the argument. You've given us things to think about. We will take this matter under advisement and issue our written ruling in due course. We will stand in recess for the next matter.